Well, let me stretch. Oh, a yawn is a silent scream.
Okay.
So, yeah, I just really want to encourage all of you to take the opportunity of giving a short talk, actually a 5-minute talk, because it's good practice, actually. And it's giving a 5-minute talk or giving a half-hour talk, it's all the same, really. So just wanted to encourage that. So I've been asked to talk about the mind precepts. So I thought I would just start generally. So firstly, it's been said that to live is to act. So you could actually say that, you know, to sum up Buddhist ethics, actions have consequences. Okay. And, you know, so there are kusala, skillful actions, akusala, unskillful actions. And as Buddhists, it's really important for us to be aware that our actions can have a beneficial or unbeneficial impact on ourselves and others. And also, it's really important that we don't go to refuge to the precepts, because if we go to refuge to the precepts, it's a trap. Okay? And Bante makes that really clear, you know, when he says that our going for refuge must be expressed by our ethical actions day by day. Okay? So, and I say that because for me, I used to go to refuge to the precepts. And what happened was I got really rigid and I got really hard and I started breaking the precepts. So it's really important, because we can fall into that trap. What we do is we go to refuge to the three jewels. Okay? And if we wholeheartedly do that, then we will live an ethical life. I want to talk a bit about these precepts, because I have a bit of a bugbear. And those of you who know me will know that. Because what kind of happens in our tradition is that we tend to focus on the positive precepts. You know, not just Mitras, I've been around order members, and we'd say, you know, what precepts are we working with? And the only thing you hear in the room is a positive precept. And what I want to say is that actually they're couplets. You know, these precepts were passed down by the Buddha via Bante, and he passed us down the negative precepts. And the positives are really important. But these precepts are precepts. They're principles to govern the mind, to train the mind, to direct the mind to act skillfully. The training happens in the negative aspect. That's where we do the training. We undertake to abstain from something. That's the training. And the fruits of the training is the positive. That's what we bring into fruition. And this is really important. And I really want you to think about taking on, reciting the precepts daily for a month, doing the negative and positive in English, and just see what happens. I remember myself years ago, I loved the precepts, and I always would say the positive precepts. If I can remember at home one day being at my shrine doing these positive precepts, and I thought, hold on a minute, I'm still doing all these things. I'm saying these positive precepts, I'm still breaking them. Why don't I start saying the negative ones? And I did, and it completely transformed my life. And I can't say how it turned around my life, but there was a huge change. In fact, you know, when I came along, people who know me, I was somebody who took recreational drugs, so I was still taking drugs. But when I started doing those precepts and the negative ones, the experience of actually taking drugs or breaking those precepts was very different. In fact, I could feel it, that it was painful. So I really do encourage you to take it up, because, you know, often we think we come on retreat, it's like, oh yeah, it's a great experience doing the refugee practice. Well, you have to ask permission to do that. You don't have to ask permission to take on reciting the five precepts in the negative form and the positive form. So what I want to say is that if we don't take the practice of precepts seriously, if we just focus on the positive ones and don't give much attention to the negative ones, Buddhism merely becomes a hobby and nothing much more. And so it's really important that we give emphasis to both and we take the practice of precepts seriously. I tend to think that as an order member, I took on 16 precepts, okay, which is in our tradition. There are the first three pure precepts, not to do evil, to cultivate the good, and to radiate love. And it's often said even a child could understand that. And sometimes radiate love is to save all beings. And then there are the three refuges, go into refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. And then we have the 10 precepts. So I tend to think of it in that way, that there are 16 precepts that we have. And they're all part of our tradition. So let's turn to the mind precepts. So I want to quote from Lao Tzu, who says that, watch your thoughts, they become words. Watch your words, they become actions. Watch your actions, they become habits. Watch your habits, they become character. Watch your character, they become your destiny. And Bante makes it very clear in the Ten Pillars that actually the mind precepts are of utmost importance, because actually it's about our inner attitudes that are expressed outwardly through our behaviour, which is why we must pay attention to the mind precepts. So as mitras, we took on 5 precepts, and the 5th one is a mind precept. And often I hear people say, oh, when you get ordained, you don't have to worry about alcohol anymore. You can drink it, you don't have to worry about it. And the first time I heard it, I thought, what are they going on about? But, you know, now I just laugh. And what I want to say is that, firstly, the 5 precepts really are a distillation of the 10 precepts. And that although the 5th one isn't explicit in the 10 precepts, it is implicit. And Bante does say that. And there are many of us, or I don't know how many of us, but some of us, including myself, who has spoken to Bante about this, saying it would be really good to actually state it explicitly. And he says he does have some regret that actually that wasn't a precept which was stated explicitly. But really now it's up to the order to make that decision. So I won't go off on a tangent about that. So I do want to talk about this precept, because in a way it's hoped that actually by the time you get ordained, that actually your attachment to alcohol has weakened. I mean, interestingly, we put the emphasis, if you're a smoker, you've got a bad deal because you're expected to have stopped smoking. But, you know, if you like your drink, you're not expected to have stopped drinking to get ordained. But it is, you know, kind of, yeah, stated that actually it's not at the centre of your mandala. Okay, and it's really at the edge of your mandala. But what I want to say to you is that those of you who still do have alcohol in your life, and even if it's, you know, once a month or once every 2 weeks or once a year, every time you buy alcohol, you are supporting an industry that causes harm. We live in North America, and practically nations and nations of First Nations people were wiped out because of alcohol. And they're still suffering now in their communities in North America, in Australia, because Westerners introduced alcohol and it's just created a disease. They actually introduced alcohol into my culture, to African people. They got my people drunk so that they could steal our land, so that we could sign. You know, and if we think about it today, we know. I have a very close friend whose nephew was killed because of drunk driving. Okay? So we are supporting an industry that causes harm. So it's just a reflection for you. But I don't want to just focus on that one because we are talking about the mind precepts. When we think about the mind precepts, we must think about samadhi, right view, okay? Which is the first stage of the Eightfold Noble Path or the Noble Eightfold Path. So, in a way, the question is, do we live our life with full awareness that every action that we do has a consequence, is the question for you. Because intellectually, we know that actions have consequences, which could be positive or negative, but do we really live our life from that place, knowing that every time we do an action, it's going to have a consequence? And that's really important for us to think about. Also, the touchstone of the mind precepts, the touchstones of right view, is the Four Noble Truths. And we accept that, okay, there is suffering. I'm sure all of us here accept that this human life will bring about suffering. But do we really accept the second truth, that there's a path that leads to more suffering? That actually we create the construction of suffering in our mind. Do we really see that samsara is the construction and the fabrication of the mind? Do we really see that intoxicants, covetousness, animosity, false views create the suffering in our mind, in our lives? Do we really believe that? And do we really believe that there is an end of suffering? And it's really important when we think about the mind precepts is to think about the latent tendencies of the mind, the anusayas. I'm a bit dyslexic, so I always have a bit of a problem saying these Pali words, but the anusayas, the seven obsessions. Okay, so the Buddha said there are seven obsessions of the mind: craving, resistance, views, doubt, ignorance, conceit, and becoming. Okay? And we need to be really aware of these obsessions of the mind, okay, if we're going to think about the mind precepts. So, in a way, what I do want to say is one of the reasons why I wanted us to do a moral inventory, not because I wanted us to be critical of ourselves, but really the precepts, it's about practice. What was the Buddha doing when he gained enlightenment? Exactly. He wasn't reading a book, giving a seminar. He was meditating. He was investigating the mind. He was practicing. Okay? And, you know, sometimes, you know, and including myself, my practice can become an intellectual exercise. It can become a philosophy. But actually, it's about practice, breath by breath, moment by moment, now. And we can impact the next now. Okay? So, kind of moving into the precepts individually. So I will speak a bit more about I undertake to abstain from taking intoxicants with mindfulness clear and radiant. I purify my mind. Often, and as you heard me speak about it earlier, I mentioned alcohol and I mentioned drugs. But actually, that's the tip of the iceberg of that precept, okay? I remember so clearly, I remember waking up in my bed. It was about 17 years ago. And you know, I'd let go of my gross intoxicants, you know, champagne, cocaine, eating disorders. And I woke up with shock horror because I could see so clearly that my biggest intoxicant was my stinking thinking. It was just there in my face, and I was shocked, and I laughed. It was just like so incredible, and I just remember cracking up, laughing in my bed. It was like, oh my God, now the work begins. And sometimes when I say that, people laugh at me. And I say, you know, thinking is a matter of life and death. It's the cause of murder. It's the cause of sexual abuse, physical abuse, road rage. Yeah, taking their lives. Yeah. So we, you know, in a way, we may feel like we're free of this, but actually the work really begins when we begin to work with the mind. This is what the mind precepts are about. And I'm sure all of us here are still working with the intoxicant of the mind. Okay. And we have to work with it kindly, with metta, softly and gently. So moving on to covetousness. Covetousness is an aspect of craving, an aspect of desire, and in a way we begin to look at that in the second precept, where we undertake to abstain from taking the not given, and with open-handed generosity we purify our bodies. And I do that because there's something in when we open our hands that we kind of open up our bodies. And in this precept we undertake to abstain from covetousness, abandoning covetousness for tranquility. We purify our minds. And I kind of was reflecting on this, and how does covetousness play out in my life? And I suppose there's the aspect of envy and jealousy, because envy is when we want something, we want to gain something, and jealousy is when we're afraid of losing something. And, you know, I can be a victim of this and I can be a perpetrator of this, but covetousness can play out where I see somebody doing something and I want to be them. I want that. And then I get envious because they're in that position and I want that. Why can't I be like that? And I've often been a victim of that as well. That's projected onto me. But I can project that. I want to be in that place. I want to be there. That's where it, one of the places it can play out for me. Bante describes covetousness as the, and I'm not going to say it verbatim, but he says it's the reaching out of the ego and the self towards a non-ego and a non-self, which is the yawning pit of the inner poverty, which is so poetic, but it's so strong. I had to read it several times. And what he says is, you know, we can't appropriate the non-self. We can't appropriate the non-ego. And because of that, there is a perpetual frustration in that precept, in that, you know, when we manifest it. And the way he suggests that we work with this is it's renunciation, really. And actually, we're all renunciates, you know. Sometimes we think, you know, in our lineage, there are the Anagarikas, and then there is us. But actually, we're all on the path of renunciation. We, you know, and we either begin renouncing now or we hold on to dear life and at the point of death. We make our choices. And all of us who have stepped onto the path have started to renounce. There are things that we have renounced, but actually, that's the path. We have to renounce everything. Okay? And so, Bante says, to work with covetousness, we can take on the practices of the recollection of the death, the recollection of impurity, the six element practice, which are, well, some of those practices are practices we do in the order, but the six element practice is a practice that we do on these GFR retreats, and it's not advised that we do them at home. But don't let that get in the way, because actually we could reflect on the four reminders. Okay? we could reflect on the four reminders to practice with covetousness. And we know the second reminder is that, you know, death is certain. We can't avoid death. Okay. So, hatred. I undertake...
Before you go to the next one, will you mind just repeating that quote, reaching out... Because it was such a good quote.
It's such a good quote, but I'm going to go to the book because I know that I didn't quote it verbatim, but I can find it in the book. Yeah, yeah. Thank you. You. It is a state, essentially, in which the self or ego reaches out towards the non-self or non-ego with a view to appropriating and even incorporating it, thus filling the yawning pit of its own inner poverty and emptiness. And it's on page 81 of the Ten Pillars. So I undertake to abstain from animosity. Changing hatred into compassion, I purify my mind. And Bhante describes this as the wish to do evil. Now, I think the word evil is a really interesting one, and we can actually bypass this. I think often we bypass this because we say we don't do hatred. And what's interesting is in my culture, in African culture, the word evil is an everyday word. You're evil. So it's not when somebody says you're evil. It's not. Oh my God! You know, it's an everyday word. So in a way, for me, I thought I would take the practice on just reflecting on how I can do evil. How do I wish evil? And you know, there are times when somebody can hurt us, and we wish that they hurt the same as us. That's wishing evil. That they're hurting. That is a wish of evil. Okay? Again, sometimes we wish that somebody got their comeuppance. That's wishing evil. When somebody gets their comeuppance, it's like they get their dues. They get what they deserve. Yeah. And sometimes when we see somebody being successful, we can wish there for their downfall. That is wishing evil. Okay? So there is, I'm sure if you take it on to begin to reflect on how, you know, how evil resonates for us, we can really begin to see how we do wish evil. And actually, it really does harm the mind. And if you notice that actually it was very similar to when I spoke about covetousness, when we want to covet something, when we wish that, you know, that we were that person there. Because Bhante also says that actually covetousness gives rise to hatred. Okay. So they're all interconnected. Also, hatred is an aspect of resentment. It's an aspect of ill will. It's irritation. You know, if we get irritated, we're moving towards the direction of hatred. That's the direction we're moving towards. That's where we're pointing to. So all of us in our lives at some point really do connect with the unskillfulness of hatred, whether it be on a subtle level or a gross level. And the thing is, it's important to notice the subtlety of it, the subtlety. Because once we've gone into the grossness, the anger, the hatred, it's too late. We're acting so unskillfully. But if we can begin to see it arising in the mind, if we can begin to see that we're beginning to feel a bit irritated, we're beginning to feel like our heart is closing down, and perhaps we can begin to open up before it gets more toxic. And he also says that love isn't enough. That actually we really do have to think about the Bodhisattva vow. And that actually we're really going to work with animosity. It's compassion, bringing about compassion. So therefore it brings us to the practice of the four Brahma Viharas. And we start at the point of metta. That's where we start. You know, from metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity arises. And so that's what we need to be working with, especially if we know that we're a hate type. You know, there are the greed type, which come in the covetousness bracket, and so need to be doing more of the renunciation. And then there are the hate types, who need to be doing more of the Brahma Viharas, but we're all a bit of each, and we need to be doing all. Okay? And also the other thing is as well, what do you think about Donald Trump? I bet some of you wish evil to Donald Trump, okay? So, moving on to undertaking to abstain from false views, transforming ignorance into wisdom, I purify my mind. It took me a long time to get to grips with this. I'm not going to say I understand it, but it took me a lot. You know, I could get to grips with the others, but you know, what was that? False views. Mitcha ditties. And, yeah. And it's in a way, it's like I give this talk today on the mind precepts, but I could give this talk a year later or 2 years later, and it would be a very different talk. So I'm really talking from my experience today, and that changes. But I think, going back to Bhante's definition, that false views is a contamination of the mental states. That actually, that's what we're looking at. And that false views do precipitate, he says, do precipitate and crystallize our unskillful mental states. And he also says that we need to be aware that our thinking is continually coming out of those false views from the moment we were born, or even when we were even in the womb. You know, that actually we are continually reforming our views. I say that we're continually reforming our views. But, you know, he says that we're always speaking from the place of false views. And I think that's really important, because I know for myself that actually where I sit here, I say I live in sweetened samsara. Okay? And I need to move out of that place of sweetened samsara. Okay? So I'm still acting out of those false views. And the reason, you know, one of the things Bhante says is, one of my favourite quotes of his is that we're a collection of habits. And the reason why, one of the reasons why I think that we're on the path is because we want to become less of our habits. You know, it's like, I often say that if we look at people who don't have a spiritual practice of any kind, you can actually see that older people, they become more and more of their habits. But actually what we're trying to do is to become less of our habits, and we become less of our habits by working through the mind precepts. Also, he reminds us that false views obstruct the way to enlightenment. So, if we've still got false views, we're not enlightened. And then, I couldn't find it, but I remember reading the material, and I'm not going to quote verbatim, but, you know, he said, there's wrong view, right view, no view. and the Tathagata had no view. All the Tathagata did was to see things as they really are, to see things clearly. So we must be really aware, because it's a trap again. These concepts are traps. You know, the quote, just take the raft as far as it will take you. And we have to put the raft down. So the teaching of right view, it's a raft, but at some point we have to put it down. Okay. So I'm going to end, because we were told this had to be a short talk, and I've been speaking for half an hour. So I'm going to end by reading something from Access to Insight, Tanisaro Bhikkhu, who says, and he's speaking specifically about the five precepts. He says, they are designed to heal these wounds and scars. Healthy self-esteem comes from living up to a set of standards that are practical, clear-cut, humane, and worthy of respect. The five precepts are formulated in such a way that they provide just such a set of standards. These standards set by the precepts are simple. And then he says, when our actions don't measure up to certain standards of behaviour, we either regret the actions, engage in one of two kinds of denial, either denying that our actions did in fact happen, or denying that the standards of measurements are really valid. These reactions are like wounds in the mind. Regret is an open wound, tender to the touch, while denial is like hardened, twisted scar tissue around a tender spot. When the mind is wounded in these ways, it can't settle down comfortably in the present, for it finds itself resting on raw, exposed flesh or calcified knots. Even when it's forced to stay in the present, it's there only in a tensed, contorted, and partial way, and so the insight it gains tend to be contorted and partial as well. Only if the mind is free of wounds and scars can it be expected to settle down comfortably and freely in the present, and to give rise to undistorted discernment. And I end with Jana Barcher, who is the chair of the London Buddhist Centre, who did a series of talks, Who Hates the Metta Bhavana? We have to begin to love the Metta Bhavana, because the Metta Bhavana is the salve that works with the wounds and that works with the scars.